Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox. Donnie is off this week at a conference, so I have two guest co-hosts joining me today. Pablo Urjihuela, our housing reporter here at Fresnoland, and Dan Zack, the president and principal planner of Zack Urban Solutions, an urban planning consulting firm here in Fresno. Today's podcast is our second book club in our series with Henry Grabar, the author of Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World. We brought him onto the show to better understand some of the underlying issues with parking in the United States, and applying some of those broad lessons here in Fresno. Today we have Henry Grabar on Fresnolandia. Henry is a journalist, author, and researcher focused on cities, housing, transportation, and the environment. Since 2016, he's been a staff writer at Slate, contributing to the Metropolis column, and his work has appeared in major outlets like The Atlantic, The Guardian, The New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. He's produced podcasts for Decoder Ring and 99% Invisible, which is a podcast that I enjoy listening to, and his research on French colonial architecture was published in Cultural Geographies. Grabar edited The Future of Transportation and authored Paved Paradise, How Parking Explains the World, which was named one of the best books of 2023 by The New Yorker and The New Republic, and it is the focus of today's conversation. Henry is a graduate of Yale with a degree in American Studies and French. Welcome to the show. To start, I just have a pretty broad question to frame our conversation. What would you say our parking problem is?
As a nation?
As a nation. Well, in broad strokes, how would you define what our parking problem is?
I think the parking problem is really one of expectations. I think we have come to believe that we are all entitled to the perfect parking space, which I define as being convenient, which is to say, literally in front of the door that you're about to walk into. Available, meaning it's free for you the moment you arrive, and also free in monetary terms in that you don't have to pay for it and there's no restrictions attached to how long you can stay there. And that to me is, that's my personal objective when I'm looking for parking, and I think it's everyone's objective. But unfortunately, it's very difficult to provide that perfect parking space and also achieve many of the other things we want to achieve as a society, as it pertains to the built environment. I would say that the primary parking problem really is that we have come to expect the perfect parking space everywhere, and we've sacrificed a lot to achieve that.
And early on in the book, you mentioned that parking is a very distinct good or service in that respect, where with other goods and services, the laws of supply and demand dictate an efficient market, but parking is a different type of good. So can you elaborate on what you meant by that?
Parking is very unusual in that, number one, it's mostly provided for free regardless of the cost to build it. And so those costs are often hidden from consumers in a way that they aren't with a lot of other goods. It gets baked into the lease of your apartment or the rent for a commercial space or for an office space because it's required by law. And we'll get into that in a moment. But I think this makes it distinct, obviously, from a lot of other things. And one of the things that makes it distinct, again, is this exact expectation. You would never expect to show up at a crowded, popular restaurant on Friday night and immediately get the table of your choice. But with parking, anything less than being able to park in that restaurant parking lot is considered a policy failure that needs to be addressed at the next municipal zoning meeting or whatever.
And parking plays a major role in how our cities develop. People think of freeways, they think of different things that affect the way cities develop, but they don't necessarily think about parking in that respect. So how are those things connected?
There has been some very interesting research about the evolution of parking in cities. And the broad strokes of it is that for the last century, we've been trying to create enough space to park in the heart of most of our cities, which at least if they existed a century ago, tended to have relatively congested and dense downtown cores. And so the quest to carve out space for all this parking has been achieved to varying degrees in varying places. And I'm sure we're all conscious of some of the places in our own hometown or the place we live now where some grand building was demolished to create a parking lot. But I think that's also an important part of understanding the whole metropolitan trajectory, because the more parking spaces that places created in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, the higher the rates of car ownership were in the decades afterwards. So it really is a kind of a path dependency situation where municipalities that were successful in bulldozing lots of downtown, in requiring lots of parking accompanying every business use, every residential use, eventually did achieve much higher rates of car ownership, car use, higher levels of traffic, and so on, which unfortunately just means you have to build more parking. So it is a hard cycle to get out of once you start building traffic, building parking and expecting people to come everywhere by car.
There was a number of wonderful and troubling vignettes in your book. And one of the ones that was really interesting was the situation in Chicago, where the city of Chicago sold their parking meters to Morgan Stanley. And there's a broad conversation about when you should think about privatizing government services. What can we take from Chicago's experiment?
I think the question of when to privatize government services is complex and depends on local context, but I think a general rule of thumb is that if it's something that could be easily done by the city government, then you should think twice about why a private company is seeking to buy out that service from under the city. And maybe a city is not the best entity to run a nuclear power plant or something like that. You don't have the in-house expertise, certainly. The parking meters, I think, do not fall under that category. Cities have proved to be perfectly proficient at operating their own parking meters. And when Chicago decided that they were going to lease some 36,000 parking meters for 75 years to a group of investors, they justified it with a pretty funny logic. Obviously, they wanted the upfront payment and they thought they were taking the good side of the trade. But even beyond that, they believed that they would be unable as the city government to raise the parking meter prices without incurring an impossible political backlash that would force them to retreat. Whereas if they leased the asset and the city government were actually no longer in control, only then could those higher parking prices be achieved. So that was one of their justifications for selling those parking meters. And unfortunately, it is proved to be a disaster for the city.
Henry, your book opens up with the story of a successful stalling of this affordable housing project in Solana Beach, California, by the coalition of residents and groups like the California Coastal Commission. Fresno may be a more inland city than Solana Beach, but as the housing reporter here for Fresnoland, I can tell you that I see the same thing happening many times during city council meetings, planning commission meetings, and other city meetings. Could you help our audience understand a bit how across the country these groups are able to successfully position themselves against these projects?
Yeah, that's a great question, Pablo. One of the things that really frustrated me when I was working on this book is that it's very hard to find reliable data on just how much our national housing production has been whittled down by all of these piecemeal negotiations at the city council, zoning board, neighborhood meeting level. We've all seen it. You go into a community meeting and people say, this project doesn't have enough parking, this project's going to generate too much traffic, et cetera, et cetera. And a developer comes in proposing 40 units, winds up building only 20 or what have you. I think this happens all the time. And I can tell you that there's a very interesting study out of Melbourne, Australia, which demonstrates that parking is actually a pretty significant source of neighborhood opposition when it comes to building new things. There's actually a great study from the Sacramento Area Council of Governments that asks people what is their opposition to new housing in their neighborhoods. And the number one thing they say is traffic and parking, and which forces us to ask the question, I guess there's two ways to think about that, right? It's on the one hand, it's good news that maybe the more pernicious roots of NIMBYism, racism, opposition to immigrants, just unfriendliness are not what's motivating the opposition to new housing. So that would be good news. But the bad news is that our desperately needed new housing is being held up by such a frivolous objection over providing parking. So that does seem to be happening and reshaping the entire country's geography as people leave high-cost states like California and Massachusetts. And are they doing that just because there's a parking problem? Perhaps.
Yeah, I'm reading that first chapter. The best word to describe it was cringy. I was reading the quotes that you pulled from people at some of those meetings, and it was incredible to me. I was astounded that people would say those things. But I think that kind of what that suggests is there's an assumption and there's a little bit of a license to say certain things in public spaces that, I don't know, it just astounded me.
Yeah, I think obviously there are more sinister objections to new neighbors that get couched in the rhetoric of parking, because parking is considered an acceptable grounds of opposition to say no to a new project. I guess where I've come down on this is I find it's very difficult to discern people's true intentions and beliefs when they say that they don't want a new building in their neighborhood. But I guess you just have to take them at their word ultimately and say, if you're concerned about parking, then we're going to address that concern. And the good news is cities now have the tools to manage the way parking is used in a way that makes it so to get out of this mid-century parking problem that obsessed city planners 70 years ago, we now have new things we can do besides just force every building to build a giant surface parking lot and force our whole city to be half parking by surface area.
Okay. We're going to transition to talking about Fresno. A lot of the anecdotes and stories in your book come from larger cities, and Fresno has some similarities, but we also have some things that make Fresno distinct as a Central California inland city. And so, Dan, you want to kick us off by talking a little bit about Fulton Street?
Yeah, sure. One of the parts of the book that I really enjoyed was the bit about Victor Gruen, who has been in my history of Fresno that I carry around in my brain. He's one of the villains. And we were the second city after Kalamazoo to pedestrianize our main street in the U.S. So we were early pioneers, and it came out very picturesque and pretty. A lot of people liked it, but commercially, it was very unsuccessful, ultimately removed like a lot of them. And some people think, oh, just removing the cars is what doomed it from the beginning. But we all know people that have gone to Europe and other places, Mackinac Island or whatever, and had a great time in these car-free spaces. And so that's not necessarily it. But part of Gruen's plan was to pedestrianize the main street. But then also they tore down blocks and blocks of dense housing that fed into Fulton Street, which is why it was the main drag. The streetcars that fed people into it had been removed a few years earlier. Fulton Street itself was a really car-free, walkable space, but they took every street outside of Fulton Street and made it a high-speed, one-way car sewer. So you have a pedestrian oasis, but God help you if you tippy-toe outside of that one street. It was very unpleasant. And then some people say that they didn't follow his vision, too. What have you found in your research about why this good idea of, hey, let's give a space to people where they're not a threat of cars and they can walk and shop and socialize in peace? Why didn't that work out in the U.S.? Was it the something unique about our culture? Was it the way it was executed? And then what do you think about the way cities like Fresno, but dozens or hundreds of others have started taking these things out and trying to put back a little bit more of a traditional Main Street environment?
That's really interesting to hear, Dan. I didn't realize that Fresno was second after Kalamazoo to try out this Victor Gruen strategy. I can't, unfortunately, I wish I had the explanation for why these pedestrian streets seem to fail in such large numbers, while some of them actually succeeded. It's very confusing, isn't it? You look at a city like Charlottesville, Virginia, and their pedestrian street is the cherished part of downtown. But I want to just pause to talk a little bit about Gruen's motivations, because I think one thing that stood out to me as I was reading about Gruen and watching his presentations was that he had very little interest in the things that made American cities great. Like, he never cited your Bourbon Streets, your Michigan Avenues, your West Villages. Like, that was not something that interested him as a model. And I think really his idea with these pedestrian streets was to imitate what he had succeeded in doing at the mall. And yes, originally for the mall, he did have plans to make those mixed use environments and bring in some residential properties. But the core was about a sort of contained, climate friendly commercial environment where you could depend on a private security force to take care of things that the municipal police might not be able to do. And I think consumers aren't stupid, right? We can recognize that if what we're looking for is a mall, then why not just go to the mall? And I think in that way, I think the pedestrian street phenomenon epitomizes this trend in US cities at that moment in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, which is to try and imitate everything that the suburbs are doing and try and best the suburbs by beating them at their own game. And it turns out that you're never going to be able to provide the ample free parking that's available at a suburban mall. You're never going to be able to imitate the kind of securitized, climate-controlled environment that exists in a mall. You can try to coordinate all the retailers so that you get the perfect mix of retail and shopping and all that, but it's very difficult to do in an actual city. And I think at the end of the day, the concept just fundamentally misunderstood what people look for when they're in a downtown. And as you say, if you're going to bulldoze the whole mixed-use neighborhood that gives that place its 24-hour life, that gives that place edges, its nooks and crannies where you might stumble into some shop that exists on a side street because they couldn't afford the rent, that's where great things in cities happen. And I think that so it represents a kind of failure of understanding that. And then more simply, also, there's just the fact that all the things that you mentioned would have contributed to the demise of that place, not least thinking of the center city as primarily a commercial zone and not as a place for people to live. And that was a real fatal flaw in a lot of those 60s visions of what a downtown should be.
Have any of the kind of of Gruen's 1960s work, have any of those projects stood out as, okay, here's how we can maybe take some of the good, get rid of some of the bad, and create some sort of balance? That's what we've tried to do in Fresno is, okay, introduce cars in a narrow travel way back through Fulton, but keep basically the biggest sidewalks in town, a lot of public art, you know, trees and whatnot, but a little bit of parking, and then calm down all the surrounding streets too and make them walkable. So it's not just one strip. And then over time, try to reintroduce the density and the mixed use. I mean, we're not there yet, but that's what the effort is here. And that's the goal, is to try to hit that balance. Has anybody really done a good job of that? I know his fingerprints are in a lot of cities and it didn't always work out. Has anybody successfully, you know, remade it?
I feel like what you're talking about sounds to me like the way that the Dutch are thinking about street design, right? This Dutch concept of the Wohner for the complete street, right? And it's less about, we're going to preserve this little enclave of pedestrian space and everybody's going to drive to it and park and then get into the space and enjoy themselves. And more about, let's think comprehensively about what our streets look like. And I think one of the things that you realize, again, if you go to a place like New Orleans, San Francisco, you go to one of these great neighborhood streets, is that they often do have traffic on them. And that is not a deal breaker when it comes to establishing great street life. In fact, in some cases, it can even be an asset because, say, at night, it might make the place feel a little safer. You do feel like people are rolling through there in their cars and you're not the only person on the street. So I don't think it's a deal breaker at all, but it does call into question the way we think about street design. And if putting cars back on the street means cars are going 40 miles an hour, then forget it. Nobody's ever going to want to sit and have a coffee outside there or stroll around and go shopping with their kids. But if you think about the way we design streets and you begin to establish that paradigm, I think, throughout the neighborhood, then I don't really see it as a failure to take that street and put the cars back onto it, as long as you're thinking creatively about it. And you look at some of these Dutch mixed-use streets, and yes, they're open to traffic, but there's lots of obstacles. And so the cars move down them very slowly, and it creates an environment where people feel comfortable also riding a bike or crossing the street without waiting till they get to a light or what have you. And so you end up with the best of both worlds.
One of the things we've heard from one of the biggest affordable housing developers here in Fresno is that it doesn't matter how much the city reduces its parking requirements. For developers, they're always going to park as close to a 2-to-1 ratio as possible, simply because here it's a very blue collar working class city. And even the poorest people, a basic requirement for them is that they need a car to get to work, to drive their children to school, to get to the mall. And so I'd love to know, how should cities think about parking requirements when their current public transportation systems just aren't really viable for a lot of the working class people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I try to be explicit in the book about the fact that this book is not anti-car. And I think one of the reasons is that in most places in this country, you do need access to a car to have access to the labor market, to go to the park, go to the beach, get to school, everything else. And undoing that is going to be a colossal work of investment, engineering, behavior change, and all that. But getting the parking right is easier. than that. And I don't think it even requires changing necessarily the rate of household car ownership. I think the question should be, how many spaces does each of those cars need? And is there a way that the parking stock could be used more efficiently? Because if you look at surveys of these buildings, they often show that not all the parking gets used up. And in fact, that may be over the degree of parking being used, because having free parking encourages people to buy cars. So there is a sort of induced rate of car ownership that happens in places that provide ample parking. And so the question might be, is there a place for these residential developers to share this parking with neighboring uses? Because this is, you see, this is something in towns of all sizes, is places where you have commercial uses, say a state government building, where the parking lot is full from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. every day, but it's empty or even closed from 7 p.m. to 6 a.m. And that's precisely the hours in which the people who live in the city would need to park their cars when they come home from work. So there are many examples of places that are trying to figure out how to share this parking between these different uses. And that means that you can get to a point where a household still owns two cars, but the building they live in doesn't necessarily require the parking to be on site. Now, maybe no developer is going to jump at that opportunity, but maybe if you set up a system where it's super easy to do that, they would. And they would think about how to share that parking between different uses. And that has a couple of beneficial side effects. One is that it's cheaper, obviously, and it makes better use of the existing supply. But it also means that there's less parking physically taking up the urban landscape, which means a denser array of amenities, attractions, et cetera. That in turn means more people walking around, which in turn creates more demand for those businesses, et cetera. So you begin to unlock that virtuous cycle. And in Los Angeles, which famously did away with the requirement to provide parking with older historic buildings that were being renovated into residential structures, what happened there is people still drive cars. In fact, they drive cars at an even higher rate than they used to, because the people who moved in recently have more money than the people who used to live in the neighborhood. But the people who drive there now park their cars in commercial garages. And what that means is everybody has a walk of a block or two that's built into their daily routine to go and get their car. And that creates street life, that creates a demand for coffee shops and drugstores and everything else. And again, it goes back to this question of, what does the perfect parking space look like? If your expectation is that you can get in your car without getting out of your building, then yes, it's going to be very hard to move away from that 2-to-1 ratio.
And as a follow-up to that, there's even a glimmer of hope in Fresno. I was just in a meeting with some folks from the Fresno Housing Authority. And about 10 years ago, they built a really nice affordable housing project downtown Fresno. And the design was on a tight site, so they could only fit, I think, something approaching half of what they would normally provide for parking on site. But there was a city garage across the street, kind of to your point about shared parking. So they leased some stalls there for the surplus. And then over the past decade or so of people living there and getting used to living in the downtown environment, walking and whatnot, slowly but surely they stopped using so many of those city garage parking spaces, to the point where they just canceled that lease with the city. And now even the on-site spots are not completely utilized. So they are experiencing that, okay, maybe we don't always need that 1-to-1 or 2-to-1 ratio. And then there's a market rate developer that works downtown a lot, knows the market really well. His newest building that he's approved to do, and hopefully will start soon, I think he's proposing 39 parking spots, 39 units, and only building 7 parking stalls, I think is the ratio that he's looking at. And he's been active for about 15 years, knows the downtown demographic, and is noticing that, okay, some of my clientele just doesn't own cars and they're walking and biking and riding the bus. And so let's use that space for more housing. So there is some dabbling. And when you remove those requirements, now you're allowing that experimentation. If it's successful, then maybe later on someone else will be willing to try, and you can reverse the cycle, even in Fresno.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And one of the reasons I think you don't see that until you start reducing the parking is, it is a chicken and egg question. And if you move into an apartment that comes with 2 free parking spaces, then not only are you more likely to buy a car and park it there because you have the free parking, and there's endless studies that show this, that these providing more parking is correlated with owning more cars, But also you'd be a fool not to, because you're already paying for those parking spaces. Like it's bundled into your lease or the purchase price that you paid. So it's all wrapped up in that. And I do think there's something to what you're saying, and it's not just about the current people who live there changing their habits, but also about this being a relatively new type of housing that's even available on the market, right? I mean, for 6 decades in most of this country, we couldn't build housing without parking included. So it really is a totally new type of product that's coming out. And I just talked to a developer out in a suburb of Salt Lake City, of all places. So not your super walkable downtown environment. And they built the parking light project. And they said at first, it was a little chaotic and there was some spillover parking happening. But as the years went on, the people who needed 3 parking spaces or 4, because this is Utah, it's a pretty big households, lots of parking, lots of cars. They just moved out. They said, you know what? This isn't for us. We thought this was a good deal, but we realized we don't like parking on a street, not being able to know where we're going to park. And people who saw the deal and said, you know what? Actually, I'll take that lower rent. I'll take my chances parking the car on the street. I ride the bus to work. They moved in. And so the problem resolved itself as people sorted out.
Henry, you had touched on this a little bit in the story about Chicago and how, hey, if we can't possibly be expected to make these hard decisions, but if we turn over this public resource to a private company, then they can take the blame for setting prices at the fair market value. And that reminded me of a question I was working out for you where you talked in the intro about how Americans vacation in places like Charleston and Manhattan and Rome, and they're nostalgic for their college years when it was maybe the only time in their life they lived in a walkable area. And I have no doubt that if you could snap your fingers and make a town like Fresno completely walkable, completely transit linked, and what parking remains is properly hidden away and priced, people would love it if they could just snap their way right into the final product. But the problem is you can't snap your fingers and completely remake a city. You have to go through increments step by step. And each step is going to be a little inconvenient and uncomfortable, even though the final vision is going to be beloved and celebrated and is really going to work. With politics being how they are, the Chicago example being a really good one, how do we make those incremental steps and get people there bit by bit? Because in the meantime, hey, you know what? You might have to pay a little bit more for parking than you used to. You might walk another block or two as that municipal lot that you really were used to parking in is now in nice infill apartments. And so you have to walk farther for that parking spot to go to your favorite restaurant. And you're mad about that in the moment, even though that's building towards something you're ultimately going to really love. How with our political system and that incremental nature that these things have to happen in, how do we get there?
That is the million-dollar question. I think the good news is that it's easier at the beginning than it is at the end, by which I mean, if you look at the cities that have changed their policy around parking requirements and liberalized their zoning to allow builders to do this kind of thing, you're looking at places like Austin, Texas, San Jose. You're not looking at places like Boston, where I live, still has parking requirements. New York City still has parking requirements. Miami still has parking requirements. Like these, or Miami Beach, I should say. These places where you've got these super walkable neighborhoods are the places where the fight for parking is the most intense, and where people depend on that public asset. They think of it as being something that they own because they've lived in the neighborhood for a long time. And they think that new neighbors should be required to have parking built into their buildings so that I, longtime resident, can continue to make easy use of the public right-of-way to store my car. So for those reasons, you've got your Phillies, your New Yorks, your Bostons that have not seen a lot of progress on parking reform, whereas a lot of these bigger Sun Belt or Rust Belt cities have had lots of success. And so I look at that and I think the lesson in that is it's in some ways it'll be relatively easy to get going on the first part, which I think of this as like the 3 circles of parking reform. There's 9 circles of hell. This is the 3 circles of parking reform. And the further in you get, the madder people become at you as a city planner or elected official. And the first one is building less parking, because that's like pretty easy, as I was saying, in a place where competition for parking is not that intense, even if fear of a parking shortage gets brought up in community meetings and so forth. And then the second step is to share the parking and to make better use of the excess you have. And whether that comes through, you know, apps like Arcade or Spot Hero or something like that, you can really put a lot of the parking you have to more efficient use. And then the third and final step is behavior change, where people actually start to say, you know what, the parking downtown costs money now, so I'm going to start riding the bus to work. Or the parking at the restaurant is hard to find, so my wife and I are going to carpool there instead of each going in our separate cars. And that's pretty marginal level changes. But at the same time, those changes don't happen until parking becomes scarce. So you're not going to see people opting to take the bus if parking at work remains free. And so this is like almost like a universal law. There's a lot of places that say we need to build out the transit system before we can start reducing parking, getting people to walk and all that. And it's true, but it's also true that no one's going to ride that transit system until it becomes hard and expensive to park. So it does take a moment of political courage to get this cycle going. But I think the optimism is that as you begin to build on all those parking lots, you create a density of inhabitants to support local businesses. And you make it a lot easier for local businesses to open as well, when they don't have to play by these arcane zoning rules governing the conversion of historic properties or how many parking spots correspond to each stool at the bar or whatever. And so you create a density that makes that walkable, virtuous cycle possible. And I think that as we begin to recover from our suburban sprawl period as a nation, you're going to see more places enter that cycle, where at first people do complain about it being hard to park, but that complaint comes at the exact same time as it becomes easier to get around in other ways.
All right, we're going to jump into some community questions. We solicited questions from across Fresno and outside of it as well, through Instagram and through our tips email. And I want to pose a couple of these to you to get your thoughts and be able to respond to the community about their concerns. This first one's kind of amusing. This is a listener from Los Angeles named Aaron, and his question was, what is the worst parking garage in the United States?
The worst parking garage in the United States is the street in front of my house where the Cambridge parking police keep giving me a ticket because I don't have a residential parking permit yet. Guys, I'm working on it. I just moved here. Are you really serving the public interest by reminding me every day?
Yeah, I really enjoyed your section in the book on the relationship between organized crime and parking structures. I had no idea that was one of the facets of their work, but very interesting. Next question, do cities as they grow, and we're thinking in terms of sprawl here, need to create more parking to match that sprawl and growth? This was a question from Instagram.
Yeah, it's a good question. I think there has been this pattern of providing more parking to accommodate the mythical suburbanite who you want to keep returning downtown. And that parking often comes at the expense of the interests of local inhabitants. It could be something as simple as retaining parking near intersections, which is a very common thing in cities, even if that means you can't daylight the intersections and make pedestrian and safety improvements so that people can cross the street. And so there's real ways in which the provision of parking actually impedes the ability of people to get around in other ways, including making it safe to cross the street, building a protected bike lane, building a bus lane, all these things. I think there's a lot of temptation to say, we're beginning to get a parking problem. We're growing a lot. It's time to build more parking. And I feel like we went down that path once as a society and it didn't work out, because you really just can't build your way out of a parking problem. But what you can do is manage the supply. And we do have all kinds of new technology at our disposal to do that.
Our next question comes from Josh. He asked, what are your thoughts on Park Mobile? And he mentioned specifically the big data breach and hack that they had. And now you're able to look up license plates through some of the data that was leaked. But he's more specifically asking how you feel about this parking meter service.
The big data issue is a concern, but it's a little out of my, little above my pay grade. So I'll just say that I think, generally speaking, it's very good news that it has become easier to pay for parking. I think one of the sources of opposition to paid parking is clunky parking meters, and you have to carry a jug of quarters around, and you have to go outside after 45 minutes and drop another quarter in because your meeting ran long with the vice president of the bank or something like that. That's bad. And so the fact that it's become much more seamless, I think, is good. I would encourage cities to also go one step further and say, if you leave the parking spot before your time is up at the meter, you should get your money back that you paid for that meter. Because it gets to this question of, what are we trying to do with paid parking? Are we trying to raise money, or are we trying to manage this limited, scarce resource in a way that makes the most of it for all the adjacent businesses, residents, everybody, et cetera? And the answer should be the latter, but it has often been the former. And I think you see that in a lot of parking policies, where they're very punishment oriented. They're not really focused on creating spaces. And I think now that we have this digital technology, to say to people, if you leave your parking spot before your time is up, you get your money back. It's a gesture of goodwill. And it says to people, we know we're charging for parking. We know you don't like it, but we're doing it to manage this space and not just to raise money.
Henry, another question we got was, we have some residents here who wonder, have we seen situations where existing businesses have been hurt by the removal of parking?
It's hard to say, because there's so few places that operate with a bona fide parking shortage. Even in New York City, where I'm from, there is usually a place to park if you're willing to pay for it, even just a couple bucks. And very few people actually come to those businesses in their cars anyway. I don't know. They certainly say that they've been hurt by the removal of parking spaces, but they also tend to underestimate the number of people who come by foot and by bicycle. And there's studies that have shown this, and they overestimate how many people drive. And I think that may be because people who drive come in and complain about parking, whereas people who come on a bike or on foot just don't talk about it at all. So I think it is certainly an issue that local businesses stand in the way of a lot of this parking progress. And it's, in a way, it's, but I think the places that have moved beyond that have reached this tier of insight where the local businesses say, you know what, it's not in our interest that it's impossible to park here. The thing that our clients, especially our clients who spend a lot of money, want is to be able to park when they want to park. It's not to be able to park for free. And those two things are not the same thing. And in fact, they can't be achieved at the same time. And so what has happened in a lot of these places is you're beginning to get local business acceptance of parking meters as a way of prioritizing those primo curbside storefront spaces for people who need to run a quick errand, who are willing to pay 50 cents or a dollar for the privilege and maintain that kind of perfect access to those businesses. And often in those neighborhoods, there is free parking just a couple blocks away for, say, a local employee. And that is, again, that's always the big problem with these places when they have free parking, is that it gets taken by the employees first thing in the morning and it's not available all day. That has been the problem since the dawn of the parking meter. It's been 100 years and it's still the exact same situation.
I was just researching something about downtown Fresno, and I found an article from, I think, 1919 complaining about employees hogging up the best spots in the morning and shoppers couldn't compete. Over 100 years ago, car ownership wasn't even that high, and this was a problem.
Yeah, there's only one way out of that, and it's the parking meter.
Two more community questions to wrap up. The next one is asking about parking for industrial trucks. So there's a neighborhood in Fresno called Tower, and someone that's very active in the neighborhood was asking if there's any issues with industrial parking being situated in residential areas.
It's interesting. I was recently talking to Aaron Ben-Joseph, who's a professor of planning at MIT and who wrote another great book about parking called Rethinking a Lot. And Aaron was telling me that when it comes to citing industrial facilities, and when I say industrial, I often mean stuff that doesn't necessarily emit pollution from the building itself. It's often the trucks, the arrival of the trucks that make it industrial. And he said the opposition to this, like an Amazon warehouse or something like that, in these neighborhoods, not even from the truck traffic so much as the sound of the trucks backing up and the beeping noise that makes, which is incredibly annoying. And if it happens in the middle of the night, it can wake you up and ruin your sleep. I do think it's a big issue. I would say that when there is this very lively movement to eliminate parking requirements, and that's true for residential and commercial buildings. But when it comes to trucks, I do think that you probably don't want those trucks operating on residential streets to the extent that you can avoid it.
Okay. Our last question comes from a local pastor named Dustin, and he's asking about his parking. He's parking adjacent to his church building, and he asks simply, what should he do with it? Or what's a good use of parking where people are only really using it once or twice a week for a service on Sunday and then maybe some meetings that happen during the week? Have you seen interesting applications of kind of sharing parking or leasing parking via churches through your research?
That's a great question. It's great to hear that there is a pastor who is thinking about how they can make the best use of that resource. There is a little initiative at Notre Dame dedicated to studying this exact issue, which is like how to make the most of church parking lots. They might want to check that out and consult some of the examples they're working with. I think option A is you find a local business and you say, hey, would you be interested in sharing this parking? The local business maybe pays a small sum to share the church parking lot, and then in exchange would be able to develop or sell the land on which they are currently using as a parking lot. And then you wind up unlocking some of the benefits I was talking about, whereas you share the parking, you enable the densification of the area without even disturbing the actual parking supply as it's experienced by drivers. And then the other option, obviously, if you really have more parking than you need, which is the case for many churches in communities, especially where the population is declining, there's the Yes in God's Backyard movement, YGBI, which I think in the state of California now permits churches to do development, certain types of affordable housing development as of right on their parking lots. That's an exciting initiative as well.
Yeah, that's Senate Bill 4. And yeah, so that's allowed now. And I'm actually working with a local church that's in the early stages of trying to get some housing built on surplus parking that they have.
Very cool.
Again, the book is called Paved Paradise: How Parking Explains the World. It's a fun, lively read with lots of insights. And Henry, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you very much.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinum, and our song comes from Stateless Rat.